The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So today and for the next few weeks, I'd like to explore some of the wisdom teachings of the Buddha. I find that these wisdom teachings offer a view of the world that supports us in learning how to live wisely and skillfully in our experience. So it's essentially, I feel these wisdom teachings offer a worldview. We live with a worldview, and our worldview that we live with most of the time generally comes to us through our conditioning, through our experience, through the way our parents lived, through what we see on television and hear on radio. There's kind of a cultural view that we live with. And this view operates basically, it's almost transparent to us, but we see our world through this view, and it kind of filters what we take in, this view of the world. So for example, one of the main views of this culture is that having things will make us happy. So we live our lives with that view, and we don't really question it or examine how it makes us happy and how it makes us not so happy. So the teachings of the Buddha describe an alternative view. The wisdom teachings of the Buddha describe an alternative view. And this view is really encapsulated in the Noble Eightfold Path. The first aspect of the Noble Eightfold Path is wise view, wise understanding. And there are many definitions or different aspects to this wise understanding that were taught in the suttas. So the three main aspects of wise understanding have to do with what is skillful and unskillful, what ways of acting in our bodies and minds supports a movement away from suffering towards happiness. That's the skillful side. And what supports a movement pulling us back into suffering, disappointment, dissatisfaction over and over again. And those are the unskillful sides of our experience. So that's the first, essentially, definition that the Buddha offers about wise view, is understanding what's skillful and unskillful. The second aspect is an understanding of the Four Noble Truths. The truth of suffering, the truth of the cause of suffering, the truth of the path of cessation of suffering, and the truth of the path leading to the cessation of suffering. So there's a framework in this view, in this worldview, around how we suffer and what causes that suffering, what leads us away from that suffering. And the third aspect of wise view has to do with understanding impermanence, dissatisfactoriness, and not-self or ephemerality. And these are the aspects that I'm going to talk about over the next few weeks, each of these three aspects. And if we have time, if I end up not speaking overly much about these, then I'll also add discussion perhaps a little bit about karma, the teaching on cause and effect, and the teaching on dependent origination, which is a further discussion about how suffering arises in our experience. Those are key wisdom teachings that kind of further elucidate the three main definitions of wise view in the teachings. But I'm going to start today by talking about wisdom itself. And about the idea of wise view and where it fits in to our practice. So I mentioned the Eightfold Path a little while ago. And the Eightfold Path is a series of, it could be thought of as a series of steps or as a series of qualities that we cultivate during our practice that leads us towards freedom from suffering, leads us towards not clinging to our experience. And these eight are wise view, and this is the normal ordering as it's presented: wise view, wise thought, wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood, wise effort, wise mindfulness, wise concentration. So the typical place of wise view or wise understanding, so the place of wisdom in this path, is at the beginning in the typical formulation. So there's some way in which we have to have a little bit of wisdom even to get started on this path of practice. There are other formulations of this Eightfold Path that put wisdom at the end. There's a teaching that formulates the Eightfold Path into three sections or three aspects: a section on ethics or sila, a section on developing meditation or samadhi, and a section on wisdom or panya. So this is the sila, samadhi, panya teaching of the Buddha. And in that teaching, the ethics comes first, the sense of cultivating wise relationships, skillful relationships with the world is the first place that that teaching begins. And then we move through cultivation of purifying our minds and looking at how our minds contribute to our suffering, how our minds contribute to our dissatisfaction. And then we move to the insight and the wisdom that comes out of those, and that informs our life. So how is it that the practice can be said to both begin and end with wisdom? Part of the answer to this is in a framing of wisdom that the Buddha offers, that there are three kinds of wisdom. The first kind of wisdom is what we hear, is information that basically comes to us. This is things that we read, things that we hear. So coming to listen to a Dharma talk or reading books, that's one way that we gain some kind of wisdom. The second way that we gain wisdom is through thinking about it, reflecting on it, thinking about what we've heard and actually reflecting on it, using our reasoning, our logical powers to understand it in the world of thoughts and concepts. And the third aspect is an understanding or a wisdom that comes through cultivating meditation, essentially, through cultivating direct experience. And this is the insight aspect of our practice. This is where we directly see something in our experience, and it no longer is theoretical, it no longer is just an idea, but it's actual direct experience. So the beginning of our practice incorporates, or the when we think about the wise understanding coming at the beginning of our path, that's more the aspects of wisdom that have to do with hearing the teachings, thinking about the teachings, and then we begin to apply the teachings. We use them as practices. And those practices lead us to see and understand things directly in our experience that confirm those teachings. And that's where the wisdom becomes insight. So many of us come to a spiritual practice because we have encountered some kind of suffering in our lives. And the Buddha suggested that an encounter with suffering will either lead to bewilderment or it will lead to search. If it leads to search, he says, we start asking questions. How can I be happier? Is there a better way to live? The Buddha phrases this question as, is there someone who knows a way or two out of this suffering? And so we start reflecting, perhaps, thinking about how we can live our lives differently. In my own experience, I know that there was a point in my life where I felt like I hit bottom. I had tried everything that I knew. And I really felt and understood this question of, is there someone who knows a way or two out of this suffering? But even this reflection is not really enough to truly alter our relationship with suffering unless we hear some kind of teaching that offers us a path, that offers us a way out that's very different from everything else we've tried. So for that to happen, the Buddha says we need to encounter these wisdom teachings. So the combination of encountering suffering and hearing some kind of teaching that tells us there's a way out, that's how we begin. That's where we begin our practice. So we need some form of understanding, some hearing of the teachings to begin our practice. And this often comes in these first two types of wisdom that I mentioned, the hearing it, the reflecting on it. But the wisdom itself does not really integrate into our experience until we've put it into practice. And this is where that third type of wisdom comes from, or comes in. That we use the teachings to help us explore our experience. These wisdom teachings that are offered in the Buddhist tradition are not simply ideas or concepts. They are ideas and concepts. But they also offer a framework through which we can view our experience. But they also offer practices. So they're not simply things to put out there meant to be believed, like the Four Noble Truths. Oh, I need to believe there's suffering. I need to believe there's a cause of suffering. That's not it. The wisdom teachings of the Four Noble Truths are ways to view our experience. And this is really what I'll be talking about in the next few weeks with each of these areas, talking about how we use the Four Noble Truths in our practice. So one of the main practices that's offered is the practice of mindfulness. What we see and understand in our experience, as I mentioned earlier, is influenced by our view, by how we see the world. And often that the way we see the world, what we learn from the world, is selective based on that view. So the wisdom teachings can kind of serve as a reorientation of the frame of reference that we have for understanding the world. Without this reorientation, we might miss some experiences because they don't fit the view that we're looking at the world with. So, for example, the teaching on not self is a fairly non-obvious teaching. We look at our experience and see, of course, there's someone here doing things, thinking things. I exist. I'm here. So our basic worldview doesn't really incorporate this view of not self. So our worldview doesn't incorporate this view of not self, and therefore we do not see the evidence in our experience that actually lets us know we are simply a process of causes and conditioning, a flow of experience, and there's no one really here running the show. So we don't see that evidence because it's not part of our worldview. And I think probably most of us would never even consider it as a possibility unless there were this idea in the back of our minds. This is something that the Buddha teaches. It's curious. I wonder, what does it mean? So it's kind of sitting there in the back of our mind. And then as we begin to explore our experience, that wisdom teaching operating in the back of our minds begins to open up our seeing of our experience so that we can see this evidence. And I'll talk about this more in a few weeks when I talk about the teaching on not self. What is this evidence? It's a little teaser for you to come back. One of my teachers, Sayadaw Utejaniya in Burma, often likes to talk about these wisdom teachings. And he often speaks about them as being just something that should go into the back of the mind, like I just mentioned, that, you know, the anatta teaching, the not self teaching, if we just drop it in there, it will begin to kind of break up our usual worldview of there being a self and allow us to get some of that information. So Sayadaw Utejaniya says that all the wisdom teachings are really meant to function like that, that it's not meant to be something we do necessarily with our experience. You know, we don't actually go out there and say, you know, when we get some teachings, we don't actually need to go out there and say, okay, how does this show me not self? It's more that it just sits there in the back of our mind and it begins to influence and break apart our normal worldview. He's often said to me that nothing I say to you is an instruction of something to do. It's just information to go into the stew of your mind. Just keep doing your mindfulness practice. Just keep paying attention to your experience. That's all you need to do, having heard this information. So that's one way of relating to these wisdom teachings. Just let them come in. And keep doing your mindfulness practice. Just keep paying attention to what is happening moment to moment in your experience. But there is another way to relate to these teachings, and there are instructions actually that the Buddha gave about using some of these teachings as reflections. So consciously reflecting, for example, when something, like for instance, a strong emotion might come over us. And having an understanding a little bit about emotions being simply a process, causes and conditions. It's arisen perhaps because of conditioning in my past, and there's something that's happening right now in my environment that's triggering it. So we begin to see our experience as a process. And the Buddha suggests in that moment of seeing something like that, reflect, not me, not mine, not who I am. So to actually bring that wisdom in through thought and reflection as we go through our mindfulness. So that's something that the Buddha actually suggests doing. But I use that kind of way of using the teachings kind of lightly. Because I think sometimes we can instead of truly experiencing what we are experiencing, which is being caught by an emotion, we use our thoughts and reflective power to kind of clobber those emotions and say, well, it's not me, I shouldn't be feeling this. So really, the mindfulness of what is actually happening in the moment is truly the way that the wisdom begins to become understood, truly understood in our experience. And that true understanding in our experience is what is called insight. And it's important to recognize that, so for instance, we might use a reflection on impermanence in our practice, you know, to kind of incline the mind to seeing where things are impermanent. I mean, impermanence is something we all know. It's not particularly surprising to us when we hear that one of the teachings of the Buddha is that things are impermanent. I mean, we see this all the time. We see, you know, the change of the seasons. We see people die. We see people born. There's always change. But it's you know, it's not particularly surprising to us. It's just kind of the way things are. And one of the ways of working with the teaching on impermanence is to kind of turn the mind to see when things end, when things begin. So allowing the mind to kind of connect with the impermanence on a conscious level, as opposed to it being unconscious, kind of just in our day of, you know, things are impermanent. It's, again, it's kind of like not really seen because it's just the way things are. But to actually begin to reflect on it and use that teaching of wisdom to point us to impermanence. But it's important to recognize that that conscious seeing of impermanence, you know, if we actually turn our minds and reflect, yes, I see this person is dying, that's about impermanence. That's more of a conscious reflection than it is a true insight. And they kind of can bleed into each other, but insight tends to come as a surprise to us. We see something, and we, when we're really paying attention, really mindful, we see how the mind actually assumes its permanence, even if only in short term. So, for instance, you might be watching a form of desire in your experience, you know, just paying attention to a feeling of wanting in your experience. And there's a way that we know it's going to end. I mean, there's a way that we know it's going to end, but the experience in the moment of it is that it is a thing. It is permanent. It is there. And if you are paying attention with mindfulness to that experience, and you get to see the moment that it disappears from the mind, you see directly in your experience the impermanent nature of that thing. And that experience can be very startling. It begins to really show us, oh, wow, this thing, a second ago it just seemed like it was really there, really permanent and lasting, and now it's gone. In a split second, it's gone. That's insight. That's where we truly begin to know these wisdom teachings for ourselves. They're no longer something that we simply reflect on. They are embedded in the way that we live. The truth of those teachings is clear to us through our experience, not just out of ideas and thoughts and reflection. So mindfulness is really the key to unlocking the wisdom in these teachings, or the truth, let's say, the truth in these wisdom teachings. And actually, I have found that a very little bit of this Dharma wisdom goes a long way. It doesn't take much to open our minds if we are mindful, if we are watching our experience moment to moment. So for me, in my experience, those two pieces come together, and a tiny little bit of knowledge, of wisdom, accompanied by a dedicated practice of paying attention, really opens our minds and hearts. I had a real experience of this, you know, reflecting back on it early in my practice. In the first few months of my practice, and some of you have probably heard this story many times. So early in my practice, I read a couple of books on mindfulness. I was away in the Peace Corps, and I didn't have access to much in the way of Dharma teachings, but somebody had sent me a couple of books. So I read these books, and the key bit of wisdom I pulled out of these books, because I had no framework really for understanding the Dharma too much. I didn't have people to talk to. But one of the key pieces of wisdom I pulled out of these books was, if you observe your emotions without acting on them, it will help you to understand your emotions, and it will help you to not suffer from those emotions. That was the main thing I got out of these books. I didn't particularly understand any of the discussion on not self or, you know, all of the other teachings, really. But I understood this little piece, that piece. And it's like, well, that sounded kind of counterintuitive to me. But I had hit bottom, and as I said, you know, it's like the way I had been living my life didn't work. It was pretty clear I was really, really suffering from some very strong patterns of anger. And so I used this teaching. You know, I began to observe this anger in my experience without acting on it, just dedicating myself to paying attention. What happens as this anger comes up? So I gave it a try. I decided I would use this teaching to run an experiment on my life. And observing this anger early in my practice, I actually pretty quickly, within a few weeks, began to see the benefits. It created some space around my anger, and I didn't get quite so pulled into it. I didn't end up in a rage so often. I was more able to handle the anger. So there was some space around it. So that small piece of wisdom bore some fruit. I could see that I was suffering a little bit less. And then one day, I was in my kitchen and I was cutting an apple. And in that, I was just being mindful. I mean, at that point, there wasn't any anger or anything. But, you know, the mindfulness had begun to embed through my day a little bit. So I was cutting the apple and I was kind of mindful. And in that cutting of the apple, I saw a thought appear in my mind about the person I was angry with. And there was a connection between what I was doing, the cutting the apple, and the thought. There was a link. I could see an associative link between those two. And I could see in that appearance of that person in my mind, the mind's inclination to jump on that thought and think more thoughts in order to get angry at him. That the anger wasn't there yet, but I saw that inclination. And the mind itself, having been paying attention to the anger for a few months, at this point, I think it was a couple months of doing this, the mind knew that that way led to suffering. And it let go of that thought. It said, I don't need to do that. Now, that wasn't something I did, really. It wasn't a choice I made. It was like the process of having paid attention to the anger had showed me the suffering of it, and the process of seeing that thought arise and seeing that movement towards suffering, it was like the mind just said, I don't think I want to go there. It let go of it, kind of like your body would let go of a pot on a stove if you touch it. It's just like, no, I'm not going to go there. And the anger did not arise. It blew me away. It was such a powerful moment. Now, it was years before I really understood all of the aspects of insight that had come into that moment. I mean, there are aspects of impermanence, of karma, of cause and condition, of how causes and conditions come together to create our experience. There were aspects of not self, of seeing how the mind would just let go without me doing it. There was the aspect of seeing that suffering didn't arise because I was mindful. The teaching from the Third Noble Truth, the cessation of suffering or the non-arising of suffering. I didn't have that context or framework, but what I did see was that I didn't suffer. And I did see that a pattern that was so strong in my experience did not appear. That little bit of wisdom from those books blew my mind. So that a little bit of wisdom goes a long way. Really, the practice comes down to the mindfulness, the dedicated mindfulness to our experience. And I like to encourage people not only to practice mindfulness in your sitting practice, but all throughout your day, as much as possible. Many of the insights I had in the first years of my, or months more, let's say months of my practice, the first months of my practice, came through daily life practice, through using mindfulness in my daily life. So this dedication to mindfulness in our sitting throughout our day allows us to experience the truth of these wisdom teachings directly. And when we've experienced those, they encourage us to keep looking, keep exploring. And when we hear more teachings, so like the insight that I had that I just described to you, as I read books then, going back reading books, I began to understand what they were saying because I had experienced it. So there's this feedback loop that happens between experience and then hearing. And this reminds me of an experience I've had. Another point about wisdom teachings is that it seems like sometimes we don't hear things that we're either not ready for or that we can't understand. It's like, it's almost as if we hear what we're ready to hear in a moment, what we're ready to use in the moment. I remember on one 3-month retreat, I had some kind of an insight, and I don't even remember what it was at this moment, but it was like this, wow, this is amazing. This is really important. Why don't they tell us about this in these talks? And the next 3 talks I listened to, they talked about it. So I realized, wow, you know, they must have been talking about it. I mean, it's not just that now that I've had this insight that they started talking about it. Obviously, I just didn't hear it. So sometimes we don't really have the framework to understand some of what we hear until we've experienced something that allows us to connect to it. But as I said, a little bit of wisdom goes a long way as we explore our experience through mindfulness. So next week, I'll talk a little bit about... Well, I actually won't tell you yet what I'm going to talk about next week because I may change my mind. So I will talk about one of the 3 kinds of wisdom that I mentioned, either talking about whether the things are skillful or unskillful, talking about the Four Noble Truths or Anicca, Dukkha, Anatta. I haven't decided yet which of the 3 I'll start with. So we have a few minutes for some comments or questions.
What was the connection between the person you were angry at and the apple? Did he have a particular passion for apples?
It was really just a thought. I mean, I was cutting the apple, and a memory popped into my mind about being at a fruit stand with him in California. And I was in the Peace Corps, so, you know, I was a long way away. But I could see that the fruit in front of me had kind of triggered the fruit stand memory. And it, you know, it wasn't particularly anything about him with apples. It was just a random memory.
On the point you mentioned about impermanence, I find myself a bit afraid of impermanence. I don't know if that's an unusual view.
In what way are you afraid of impermanence?
The idea that what I am attached to, what I love, could be gone in an instant of stepping off a curb, which happened to one of my dear friends. You know, that sudden dying before one's time. I'm probably not very far down the path. I am very attached to my children and my life and my identity. But, and so the idea of impermanence is threatening and scary to me.
Well, that's part of why we suffer over it. I mean, it's a truth. I mean, it's a very natural thing to be afraid of it in some ways. I mean, that's actually part of the beginning of recognizing suffering. Things are impermanent. When we are attached to them and they disappear, we suffer. And it's not so much that we're like trying to become indifferent to things. It's not it. It's it's more about actually, in my experience, as I become more and more accepting of impermanence, my heart opens more and more. And there's more compassion and more love that can come and go when there's not that barrier of fear. So it doesn't make us indifferent. It actually allows us to connect more fully when we're not afraid of impermanence. So it's an exploration. It's something we have to work with, and it's about our relationship to impermanence. That's where we need to explore. And go ahead, you had something else.
But how can you become okay with impermanence? I'm missing something.
Well, that's a place. Okay, so that's a question for you. You've heard this idea of impermanence. What the teaching says is explore in your experience what happens when things are impermanent. How is the suffering created? What is that suffering about? And what you'll begin to understand and see is the suffering is about a contraction in your own heart and mind. And that contraction is optional. And in the mindfulness, you begin to see there are moments as we pay attention, there are moments when we see in the midst of that suffering, in the midst of that contraction, that it'll let go a little bit and we'll experience less suffering around the impermanence. There'll be an acceptance, more of an acceptance of this is the way it is. And then we see there's less holding, less suffering around it when we accept it. So there's an idea, I think we have an idea that if we're not suffering over the loss of a dear friend, I mean, there will be sadness. There can be sadness without tightness and clinging. There can be a truth about sadness, but it can feel just like a flow as opposed to coming in and getting stuck. It's not that we don't experience sadness anymore, but it's that we don't suffer from that sadness. But it's an exploration for you. I mean, I can tell you this, and it's like I'm not asking you to believe it, but I am asking you to look in your own experience. Pay attention with mindfulness, and you may start to see what causes you to suffer around impermanence. And you may start to see times when you don't suffer, and that will be a lesson for you. So we need to stop. We have to stop, unfortunately. It's our after time. So I'm here. I can hang out for a few minutes if people have questions more they'd like to ask.